Let me just say this. The Jews are special to God, and I've said that many times. From the time of Abraham on, the Jews have always been the special chosen people to God, and yet they have not been perfect, and we know that, and they have been afflicted many times during their rich history. But nobody has ever afflicted them up to this point like the man Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a very wicked guy, and we're going to see some more of his treachery in these verses, three verses that we're going to be looking at, as we take a look at what I call a dash of deceit.
The Bible says that the gospel of Christ is the power of God unto salvation. Welcome to Pulpit Power, featuring Pastor Tony Skeving, senior pastor of Fargo Baptist Church in Fargo, North Dakota. Today's message was previously preached before a church audience. And now, here's Pastor Skeving.
Let's take our Bibles, please, and turn back once again to the book of Daniel and the 11th chapter. And timeline-wise, it's about 530 B.C. Okay, Daniel's 90 years of age, and he's been in Babylonian captivity for over 70 years now at this point. So it's about 530 B.C. roughly. And he is the last of the major prophets, as we call them that. The minor prophets follow this book. And they end with the book of Malachi. Well, Malachi, timeline-wise, is about 400 B.C., 400 years before the time of Christ. And then you have the 400 silent years, no prophets, and we call that the intertestamental period between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so what Daniel is getting here from Gabriel, who's getting it from God in 530 B.C., it's what's going to be happening to the Jewish people in between the testaments. You follow me so far? So the year here that he's actually seeing of what's going to be going on is about 175 B.C. And so that'd be, what, 225 years later, something like that. And what is going to befall the Jewish people in the latter times? Now, let me just say this. The Jews are special to God, and I've said that many times. From the time of Abraham on, the Jews have always been the special chosen people to God, and yet they have not been perfect, and we know that, and they have been afflicted many times during their rich history. But nobody has ever afflicted them up to this point like the man Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a very wicked guy, and we're going to see some more of his treachery in these verses, three verses that we're going to be looking at, as we take a look at what I call a dash of deceit. And here in Daniel chapter 11, we pick it up in verse number 21. It says, "And in his estate," now that was Seleucus the fourth Philopater, "in his estate shall stand up a vile person," that's Antiochus, "to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with an arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people." Now, who is Antiochus Epiphanes? Well, there are a number of Syrian kings, but this is the most famous, not the best, but the most famous. You say, well, why? Because of what he did to the Jewish people. We've covered this many times. God's not so much interested in what the rest of the world is doing. The camera of heaven is really on Israel, the navel of the earth, I've called it many times. And if people pass by that camera and get in on the picture, they get acknowledged by heaven. And so it is with this guy behind me. He was a scoundrel. The Bible calls him vile. That's how we're introduced to him. How would you like that for an introduction? He is vile. He is despicable. He is diabolical. And there's not really enough adjectives about him. But Antiochus Epiphanes is a picture of the Antichrist. That's why it's important. I mean, otherwise it's just crusty, dusty, musty old history. But something happened back in 175 B.C. that is a picture of something that is yet to happen. Yay, and I was talking to somebody before the service today of world events and things going on. And folks, it is so close. It's probably closer than we realize. And there perhaps right now, somewhere on the earth, could be this man alive that is going to be known as the Antichrist. We don't know, but he may be alive even right now in the world. And he is foreshadowed by Antiochus Epiphanes. They do the exact same things. There are so many similarities in them that they parallel each other. And Antichrist is going to persecute the Jewish people as well. He's going to persecute the whole world. But he's going to probably annihilate somewhere around two-thirds of the Jewish people. He's going to outdo Hitler when it comes to anti-Semitism. And the Bible tells us in the book of the Revelation that the guillotine is going to be revived. There's going to be a massive genocide. A lot of people are going to die. And the roots of all of that, the incredible persecution of the Jewish people, find their roots in this man behind me, Antiochus Epiphanes. So remember this about prophecy. It often has a near fulfillment. It often has a far fulfillment. In fact, 1000 B.C., you find David back there writing the Psalms. He's talking about a lot of things, and he was feeling them, and it was in his heart, and perhaps it related to him a little bit, but so many of those actually were related to Christ. That was the far fulfillment, and they were fulfilled in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so history often repeats itself, and the best picture of the Antichrist found in the whole Bible is Antiochus Epiphanes, and both of these men were and will be absolute control freaks. Control freaks. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes couldn't lick Rome, and yet he had to pick on somebody. That was just him. He had to get the upper hand somewhere. So he went out of his way to harass and to torment and to seek control over the Jewish people. I mean, there's something about them. There's just a mark on them. And so they're like a grain in the eye of Antiochus. Well, and the Antichrist is going to be a control freak as well. He's got a big ego, and he's going to cause all people to receive a mark in order to buy and to sell. And he's going to peddle it as a good thing. He's going to say, hey, this is going to eliminate the black market. This is going to eliminate the drug cartel. This is going to eliminate the mafia. This is going to eliminate people cheating on their taxes. And so we're going to do away with cash. We're going to make you take this mark, and we'll get rid of crime. But that's not what it's about. It's actually about control. Remember this. From the very beginning, Lucifer has been a control freak. He's always wanted control. That is the problem in nations, who's in control. That is a problem in churches, who is in control. That is a problem often in your home, who is in control. So the Antichrist is going to want to keep tabs on everyone. And he is not going to be tolerant of anyone who does not get this mark. We read in Revelation 20, verse 4, John says, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded, which had not worshipped the beast, that's the Antichrist, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. So what's going to happen to those who resist the Antichrist? They get beheaded. They get decapitated. The Antichrist will not tolerate any defiance to him. Antichrist will be given power over all nations, and the Antichrist is going to start out charming. And he's going to, from that, use wile and guile to seize power, and then he's going to go berserk. He's going to get control. He's going to have the armies, and with that power, and we talked about it last time, he's going to go berserk. So there are a number of parallels between the Antichrist and Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, in verse number 22, just by way of review, it says of Antiochus, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown. Now, we talked about that arms of a flood being an invading army, and it wasn't very big. He didn't need a big army at that time, but all he was trying to do was get back at those who withstood him coming into power. But the word overflown there, we know what the flood is, but what's that overflown? It's the Hebrew word yafat, and it means they will be inundated, they will be conquered, they will be destroyed, they will be decimated, they'll be done in with, they'll be done away with. He's going to just wipe them out. And then it goes on in verse 22 and says, shall be broken. And then notice this last part. Yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now, who's the prince of the covenant? Remember, this is all written a few hundred years before it took place, but it played out just like God said it would play out. And there would be this one known as the prince of the covenant. Who was that? Well, it involves Hellenism. Now, remember what Hellenism is? We talk about the American way. Hellenism is the Greek way. It's the Greek culture. And Antiochus was totally enamored by Greek culture. Now, he couldn't compete with the Roman army. He couldn't compete with the Roman roads. He couldn't compete with the Roman Empire. But he still wanted to make his mark somehow. And so, he thought, I will make my mark by Hellenizing his part of the world. Rome's a long ways away. And so he went about to Hellenize that part of the world. But he knew there would be a people that would totally dig in. Can you guess who they were? As he went about to indoctrinate, he had an agenda, but he knew there would be some people who wouldn't go along with it. By the way, there is a crowd today, and they don't like what we stand for, and they know who we are, and they know who their opposition is. And Bible-believing Christians like us, they're well aware of us. Just don't be naive. They talk about us. And don't think for a second they're dumb. Foolish? Yes, they're really foolish. Dumb? No, they know who their opposition is. So Antiochus knew beforehand where his opposition would be, where the resistance would come from. It would be those Jews. And so he'd have to do something about the Jews. He knew about their worship. He knew about Jehovah. He knew about how to desecrate the temple. He had been studying them. He was going to defile it with pig swine. And the bottom line is they know. They know. Again, the Jews to Antiochus were like a grain of sand in his eye. And so he would go after them. And by the way, the Antichrist will go after Christians. And I talked about this. You say, but Pastor, won't we be raptured? We'll be gone. I believe that. But God will send a gospel witness, a couple of witnesses back who will win 144,000 to Christ, and revival will break out, and persecution has always been good for the spread of the gospel. And the guillotine will be working overtime, and Christians will be put to death once again. But the devil knows who his opposition is, and Antiochus knew it. It was these Jews. To the Jews, they just didn't have a religion that was a part of their life. You need to understand something. It was their life. It still is to this day for Orthodox Jews. And I understand that world out there that where religion is kind of a tidy little thing that, you know, it does well for business, or if you're in politics, it's good to have the name of a church where you attend and so on. And before I was saved, honestly, that was my world. You just kind of go to church Sunday, you get it over with, you go do your own thing. But when I got saved, Christ was no longer a little part of my life. He was my life. And to the Jews at that time, for many of them, God, Jehovah, was their life. So here you have Hellenism and you have Judaism, and they're on a collision course. And something's got to give here. And Antiochus became absolutely obsessed with changing the Jews. And by the way, there is a crowd today that is obsessed with changing the thinking of America. Do you follow what's going on out there? I mean, it's bad. And honestly, if we are silent as far as God's people go, they will succeed. They have an agenda, and they're vocal about it, very vocal about it. And do not be bullied into submission to them. We have to speak up, all right? So here's Antiochus. He's obsessed with changing the Jews. He's trying to get them to recant of their faith and basically embrace his ungodly agenda. And of course, all that sounds familiar. It's going on yet today. Human nature hasn't changed since Adam and Eve. And the bottom line is, those who stand for Christ and live for God and have some biblical standards and want to have some semblance of holiness, at least, are an irritant to those who hate all of that. That's called conviction. You try and live a godly life, and it's going to make the world uncomfortable. It could happen at the office. It could happen in your neighborhood. It could happen in your family, but it's called conviction. Nobody likes to feel uncomfortable. So here's the Jews. They're an irritant to Antiochus, and they rubbed him the wrong way. So at the time of Antiochus' Epiphanes, unlike the days of Jephthah and the days of David, they didn't have a judge. They didn't have a king. The closest thing they had to a leader was the high priest of Israel. There was nothing politically. The highest authority at that time was the high priest. And I'm getting back to verse number 22, who the prince of the covenant is mentioned there. The highest authority at that time is the high priest, kind of the pastor of the temple, if you want to put it that way. So if Antiochus is going to succeed, he's going to have to take down the high priest. He gets it. He gets it. Now, when we hear of the high priest of Israel, what do we think of? We think of Caiaphas, don't we? We think of Annas. We think of corruption, wicked guys like that. But that would be 200 years later. So this is 200 years earlier. And at the time of Antiochus here in 175 BC, the high priest was a godly man. I gave you his name last time, Onias. He's actually Onias the Third. You can Google his name if you want, but he was very, very likely a believer. He was very sincere, and fact is, he was awaiting the coming Messiah, and he was an honest man. He was a true man of God. That's the Prince of the Covenant, okay? And it mentions in verse 22 that the enemies of Antiochus are going to be broken. Notice that word. Yea, also the Prince of the Covenant. So evidently, Onias is going to go down somehow. Antiochus is going to be able to bring him down. How did this happen? Well, it involved a traitor, a Judas, and somebody that would be a rat fink and to work against Onias. And honestly, the devil always finds somebody like that. There's tactics that don't change. So Antiochus needed a turncoat. He needed a backstabber to take down godly Onias. And Antiochus was no dummy. Onias had some godly followers. And so he had to go about this carefully, and he needed the right guy. And so he turned to what is called the Tobias faction. Does that name ring a bell? Sanballat, Tobias, okay. These guys just, their descendants just lingered on, okay? And they stayed evil. So there was a Tobias faction at this time, and these were power-hungry Jews. And they wanted control of the temple. They did not like Onias. Again, control freaks. They wanted their way. They wanted control of the temple. And they were going to have to get rid of Onias to get rid of this godly sect of Judaism. And by the way, the reason it was so corrupt with Annas and Caiaphas and those rat finks by the time of Jesus Christ, this is where it started, okay? The high priest office was a good thing up until this point, but you're hearing where it started. Now, when it came to taking down Onias, all the Jews should have been united around him. I mean, doesn't that make sense? You'd say, boy, they'd lock arms together. They should have been on his side against Antiochus Epiphanes. Yes, they should have been. But we're going to find out that many of them turned on Onias when the opportunity came, and he was betrayed by a number of Jews, but there was one in particular who stabbed him in the back and pulled off an inside job, and Antiochus knew how to pull it off. It was a case of divide and conquer. So if Antiochus could find a way to divide the Jews, he could conquer him. And let me just say this. In any organization, there's always somebody disgruntled. I mean, that goes for our country, that goes for your home, that goes for a church. There's always going to be somebody disgruntled. Never forget that. And the devil always knows who they are, and he can work from within. This might be going on right now in your home. There might be something brewing in your home with one of your kids, and they're disgruntled, and you might not even know what's going on. This is always going on in a New Testament church. Did you know that? At some level, to some stage, it's going on right now. Don't be shocked. And I don't. You say, do you know some? I don't know of anything. I really don't at this point. I just know the devil, and I know how he works. And I know at every moment in the history of the New Testament church, he is working behind the scenes trying to do this. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, right? So here's the devil, and he hated the Jews, and he's going to use Antiochus Epiphanes. But Antiochus Epiphanes is going to use an insider. And here's where it gets ugly. When Antiochus Epiphanes finagled his way to the throne, he was already aware of the godly high priest Onias, and he needed to dispose of him. If he was going to hijack and Hellenize Israel, Onias stood in his way. He had to do something about him. So Antiochus found a Jewish ally by the name of Jason. Jason. Now, Jason is not a Jewish name. Jason is a Greek name. But Jason's name before was Joshua. He was Jewish. He changed it. And here's the irony of the whole thing. Guess who Jason was? Jason was the brother of Onias. You can Google this. Onias's brother is going to do him dirty. You know, Paul said this, also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them. Now here's godly Onias. Here's his brother Jason. Onias is not going to budge. He's staying true to his convictions and his doctrine. But then you have the Tobias faction, and they are bent on taking Onias down. They wanted to lower the standards. They wanted to corrupt the temple. They wanted to make a business out of it. They wanted to compromise, and they wanted to get rid of godly Onias. And so they're going to work through Jason. So Jason and the Tobias faction, they work together, they band together to get rid of that fuddy-duddy, Onias, and to get him replaced. And so here's the brother of Onias, who better to do it. So here's how this played out. Remember when Seleucus, now Seleucus was the brother of Antiochus. He was the rightful king at the time. And Antiochus at that time was a hostage in Rome. So Seleucus needed some money to pay the payment, the final payment to Rome for starting that war. So he sent his treasurer Heliodorus to Jerusalem to ransack the temple. Well, who stood in his way? I told you at the time, it was the high priest. Who was the high priest? It was Onias. He's the one who stood Heliodorus. And now Antiochus is back, and he remembers that. He has some dirt on him. And here's the bottom line. When Onias was supposed to do something for the government, he did not conform. And that sounds familiar as well. So Onias gets called to stand before the king. And guess who says, I want to go along with you? Jason. Jason goes along with him. So Antiochus brings in Onias. He threatens him and dismisses him. But outside the courtyard, Jason is listening to all of this. And he asks for permission to see Antiochus afterwards. He goes in. He stands before the king. And he says, you know, I'm kind of in line to be the king the next high priest, I should say. And so what would you think of me giving you 300 pieces of silver to be the next high priest? Now, the office of high priest would eventually be continually bought. And that's how corrupt it was by the time of Christ. The Tobias family had the money. They wanted to get rid of Onias. They had put Jason up as their man and said, we will back you and we will pay Antiochus 300 pieces of silver to make you the new high priest. Well, it can get pretty political when the devil wants control. There was actually some dickering that went back and forth, according to historians. Antiochus asked for 400 pieces. They settled at 350 pieces of silver. They made a deal, and the office of the high priest was purchased at that time. Onias was out, Jason was in, and this was the beginning of the corruption of the office of the high priest that you see by the time of Jesus Christ. Now, the devil has control of the office of the high priest. Shortly after that, guess what? Onias is slain. And the last part of verse 22 is fulfilled here. Also, the prince of the covenant. He goes down, he is broken, he is slain. But the saddest part is something there in Judaism was lost that was never recovered over the next 175 years. It was still corrupt by the time of Jesus Christ. That is what happens when God's people lose their identity. Can I say that again? Because that's so important for us to remember. That is what happens when godliness and God's people lose their identity. That is what happens when the devil takes a church down. That has happened all over America over and over and over again. Something special is lost, and it's lost forever. The devil is clever. Now, the Bible speaks of us not letting Satan get advantage of us, for we're not ignorant of his devices. Can we look at history and see what's happened and know that the devil's not new? Solomon said there's nothing new under the sun. This continually goes on, and we should be able to recognize his devices. Now, sadly, when Jason hijacked the office of the high priest, that authority of the temple was all lost. And the sad part is there were people who went with him. There will always be people that go with them. Know this about human nature. It has a bent, and it's not toward going up. It is never toward going up. It is not toward maintaining truth or taking the standard higher. That bent is always toward slipping and going down some notches and going down instead of up. And we have to be continually striving, folks, to lift the banner up, because the tendency is for it to go down like that instead of up. So we have to be continually striving to raise that banner, because by nature, we tend to dip the banner. That goes for all of us. That goes for every generation. Folks, let's hold fast to truth and righteousness. May God put some iron in our backbone and some grit in our craw. Here's old Onias. He wouldn't budge when it came time to compromise. He stayed true to his biblical convictions, and he wouldn't budge. But there has always been a crowd, and always will be a crowd, that wants to lax the standards, to lighten up and to loosen up. And every age has those. And believe me, they were at the time of Onias as well. There was a crowd that said, you're too legalistic, you're too strict. And we hear that yet today. Bottom line is, we're just too biblical. They don't really want to follow the Bible anymore. And the devil knew that Onias needed to go. He had to go. And so he had this plan. Jason, the brother of Onias, took him down. And a man's foe should be they of his own household, right? Christ said that. So now Jason's a new high priest. He goes back to Jerusalem. He compels the Jews to compromise. He's been bought and paid for. Basically, he's no man of God. All he can talk about is social reform and so on. And here's Onias dead, the one who is holding the thing together. And when he got ousted, the thing fell apart. You know, there's a principle mentioned in the Bible. It's good for us to remember this. The Bible says, smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. Do you think the devil knows that? Obviously, the devil knows that. And if he could take out godly Onias, if he can take out the godly spiritual leader, he can destroy the flock. And with Jason, a number of people now turn their back on the truth and the faith. And Jason was basically a wolf in sheepskin clothing. And he compelled the people of Israel to forsake the old paths and the temple. Now, Tobias and his faction were the ones who backed up Jason. And now he's their puppet. Really, the bottom line is he's on strings. He's under their thumb. The Tobias plan, or the Tobias clan, was even more liberal than Jason. And history tells us, next to the Tobias clan, Jason would be like a moderate, okay, a middle-of-the-road guy. So the Tobias clan wanted to take this thing even further toward the left, and they had even a new guy that would make it even worse. And you can Google his name, Menelaus. It's Menelaus. And so a year went by or so with Jason as the high priest, and the Tobias clan this time went straight to Antiochus. They said, we have a new guy that we want to make the high priest. And so for several hundred pieces of silver, the high bid, we find out that now Menelaus is the new high priest. And Antiochus figured out, I can make this a yearly thing. So they kind of set it up. Every year you come and we'll figure out who's going to be the next high priest. So now the Tobias clan has bought the office of the high priest for another 300 and so pieces of silver. Jason is out. Menelaus is in. And Menelaus was a total apostate. He had no time for God whatsoever. In fact, here's a quote from a historian from Menelaus. He said, I will destroy Judaism branch by branch, quote unquote. He said, I will take it down branch by branch. And so we find here now, Antiochus has figured out that he can work with an apostate religion to accomplish his goal. That's important for us to hear. I said Antiochus figured out he could work with an apostate religion to accomplish his goal. You say, what's that have to do with us today? Everything. Man is incurably religious. Just know that. Circle the globe and you find people worshiping. Man is very religious. Well, Antiochus figured out he could use religion to accomplish the end. The Antichrist is going to do the exact same thing. If you've studied Revelation chapter 17, you find the mention or the hint at least of an apostate religion. Founded in Rome, it's called a harlot. It has a bloody history of persecuting the saints. The Bible mentions she's drunk with the blood of the saints and going to ride in on the back of the beast. That's symbolic. It tells us that the Antichrist and this religious system are going to yoke up and join arms, and they're going to rise to the top together, and then the Antichrist is going to turn around and destroy that apostate religious system, which is exactly what Antiochus is going to do. Now, back in the days of Jason, there was a remnant that remained true to their convictions. I am glad to say that. That is the good news. There were some Jews who were labeled Hasidic Jews. Now, these are terms that are still around today, folks. All right? Hasidim. All right? We talk about the Hasidim. That means the pious ones. That means the devout ones. Of course, to the heathen or the apostates, they were mocked. They were called the goody two-shoes and the narrow crowd and the holier-than-thou, and they were persecuted by the liberal crowd. And so we find this in verse 23. It says, "And after the league made with him," that's the league that Antiochus made with the apostates, "he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall be strong with a small people." So the he here is Antiochus. And what's this about him becoming strong with a small people? Well, again, he didn't have a big army. He didn't have a lot of power. He couldn't overcome Rome. And so as he rose to the top, he had to use deceit to do it. And he also knew he had limited resources. So now when Antiochus and Jason and Manelis introduce the liberalism to the Jewish nation, most of the Jews actually apostatized eventually. Some withstood for a while, but some threw in their hat right away, and others, they slowly came around. And before we're done, you're going to hear how bad it got. I don't know if I'll get to it today, but they compromised. And, of course, they were intermarrying with heathen, and they were losing their identity, and they were casting off biblical convictions, all of that. And let me just stop here and say, folks, that's human nature. We can hear that and gasping, and, oh, that's awful. But all of us have to guard our hearts from doing this. And let me just say, it's going to get rough before the Antichrist comes on the scene. And how rough before the rapture, we really don't know. Before the Lord comes back, it could get pretty rough. And sin is going to abound. We know that. And in Luke 18, Jesus said, "When the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?" That's sobering to me. You know, the more sinful it gets, the harder it will become to stand for truth. Now, here in our country, we've had our heyday, and that's come and gone. And we're following the likes of England and places in Europe and so on, where they don't know that they don't know. I mean, they just are clueless about the things of God. And as a country, we're living in the post-Christian era. We really are. We've seen our heyday, and now we're living in the time when Christ is soon to come back. And will he find faith on the earth? Because the more sinful it gets, the harder it is going to get to stand for truth. In fact, Jesus said, "And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." Oh, may it not be us. May it not be Fargo Baptist Church. May our love for the Lord not wax cold. But I have been a believer now for over 42 years. And it has gotten obvious. It's gotten very noticeable how believers are caving in. How believers are compromising. How believers are dipping the banner. And they're buying into it. You get bombarded with it enough. You hear it every day. It's there at work. It's there amongst your relatives. It's there in your neighborhood. And sin can take its toll on your resistance after a while. How long can you resist it? It's a sign of the times. And as iniquity is abounding, and it is, it's filthy out there, the love of many is waxing cold. It's so easy to go with the majority. It's so easy to go with the flow. I mean, we all get tired of fighting the system. We all get tired of fighting sin, our own, our flesh. But you know, the Bible has this to say, "Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not." Let us not be weary. You know, what does that mean in the Greek? It actually literally means weakened. You can get worn down. You can get weakened by the iniquity abounding out there. And you get weak in that battle. It's like holding a 4x8 sheet of plywood out in a 40-mile-an-hour wind all day long. You're just worn out by the end of the day. And in this world, this sinful world which we live in, your resistance wears down. And so we're admonished, let us not be weary or weakened in well-doing. You know what that means in the Greek? It means doing virtuously. We're trying to be virtuous people, aren't we? And you can get weary in being virtuous. And a lot of people, Christian people, believers, have abandoned their virtue. Don't abandon your virtue. Don't get on that wider road. At the time of Jason and Manelis, there were a number that just yielded to all the liberalism. They dropped the truth. They abandoned their standards. You know that every age has people that are just looking for a reason to dip the banner. Did you know that? Every age has a remnant that want an excuse to abandon the old path and live more carnally. And when that excuse comes along, they can easily cast off their convictions. And that's what happened at the time of Jason and Manelis and Antiochus and Tobias and that crowd. When the opportunity arose, they went, okay. You know, if you feel right now like you're under some kind of a yoke living the Christian life, chances are you might go that route when the time comes. If you feel that you're being restrained in some kind of a spiritual harness or a straitjacket, and it's like the Christian life is a chore to you, and it's a burden to you, and it's a duty to you, and it's a grief to you, your heart's probably not right. And I say that in kindness. If you really are right with God, if you really love the Lord, it's not a chore to keep His commandments. In fact, Christ said, if you what? Love me, keep my commandments. He talked about that. And John put it this way, for this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments. And His commandments are not grievous. Not if you're right with God. They're not a grievous thing to me. It's not a duty to live the Christian life. It's a delight to live the Christian. It's a privilege to live the Christian life. It's not a yoke to cast off. It's a joy. Are you looking for an excuse to abandon your standards? You know, Jeremiah put it this way. Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein. And ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. You know, every age has had those people. They don't like the old paths. It's a grief to them. Most people at the time of Antiochus followed Jason and Manelis into compromise. And it really is a good place for me to stop and say, what would I have done? And it's a good place for you to say, what would you have done? You know, we really don't know our hearts sometimes. And believers can say, well, I'd never do that. Are we sure? We just don't know. Never, ever, ever underestimate the depravity of the human heart. I find that when the Jewish people were in bondage in Egypt, they were like, oh God, if you'll just get us out of this. And finally, after hundreds of years, God did. And after miracle, after miracle, after miracle, they're out there in freedom. And what do? They start complaining about the water. They start complaining about the manna. They start complaining about the quail. They start complaining about Moses. They want to go back. They build a golden calf. And honestly, if you had asked them, okay, if we let you out of Egypt, will you act this way? Oh, never, never. But you know, we really don't know our hearts sometimes, do we? We don't know our hearts. Well, I got to close with the good news. The good news is, there were some Hasidic Jews. We'll talk about them more next time. The Hasidim, the pious ones, they were the goody two-shoes. They were the mocked ones. They were the narrow crowd, the holier than thou. But they loved God. And they didn't budge for anything. And they took a stand. And in the midst of all that deception, all that deceit, all that carnality and worldliness at the time, they said, we love God and we're going to finish strong. God help us to be like that, as we live in a very similar time as they lived back in that year 175 BC.
You've been listening to Pastor Tony Skeving of the Fargo Baptist Church in Fargo, North Dakota. If you would like a CD of today's message, you can obtain one by sending a gift of $2 to Fargo Baptist Church, 3303 23rd Avenue South, Fargo, North Dakota, 58103. That address again, Fargo Baptist Church, 3303 23rd Avenue South, Fargo, North Dakota, 58103. We hope you'll join Pastor Skeving next time right here on Pulpit Power. Pulpit Power is a production of Heaven 88.7.